Two big things, okay? Two big things, and then we get to the show, all right? Hang tight with me for two big things, and then we're going to get to a really fun show, all right? First big thing, Marmalade Music, who you know mixes and masters this show and all of my music. You can go hear their work on my latest single, Unknown, by looking up Austin Archer on Apple Music or Spotify or wherever else you stream music. Marmalade Music, audio engineering company that can make your single, your EP, your album, your podcast, whatever your audio project is. They can take it to the next level, make it sound better. They're running that promotion that I mentioned last week for another week, okay? So usually I drop the podcast on Wednesdays, and then let's say a week from Thursday, okay? So if you're listening to this on Thursday, you've got 7 days to get on that amazing promotion that Marmalade Music ran that I was like, Chris, you're out of your mind for running this promotion. And he was like, just run it. And I was like, dude, you need to calm down. And he was like, you need to calm down. You remember that? Well, they're running it for another week. So for 7 more days, you can go to marmalademusicslc.com, tell them that you listen to People Pleaser, that it's your favorite podcast, that you have a big crush on the host, and Chris is going to mix and master your first song for free. Okay? It's insane. It's a crazy value. It's a crazy deal. You've got 7 days to go to marmalademusicslc.com, tell them that you listen to People Pleaser, and get your first song for free. Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing, are you ready for this? All right. So I talked a few episodes ago about phase two of this podcast, and phase two was getting all of y'all involved and getting more ears in this blanket fort, okay? Because you've all been so good about coming back week to week. We've been really good on audience retention, and I'm very proud of that, and I'm so thankful to all of you for coming back week in and week out, all right? Now, here's my plan, well, one of many, to get you involved. Right now, this is what we're going to do. If you go to Apple Podcasts and you give this podcast a 5-star rating, and then leave a review, I'm going to read your review on the podcast, and then I'm going to review you back, all right? And in that review, you can tell me if you want something plugged, if you have something happening that you want me to talk about on the show, if you have a play that's happening, or a song that you're releasing, or like a really cool photo or post that you posted on Instagram that you didn't think got enough love and you want me to direct people there, whatever it is. You can let me know either in your review, or you can like DM me on Instagram or Facebook and let me know what you want me to talk about. Otherwise, I'm just going to kind of give you a general review of things that I like about you. All right. So again, you go to Apple Podcasts, you leave a 5-star rating on this podcast, and you leave a review. I'm going to read your review on the air. All right. So, I mean, you can like write something funny or silly. You can even like make fun of me if you want. Like you can write a funny joke in there if you want, or you can just write what you actually like about the podcast. I'm going to read your review on the air, and then I'm going to review you back. So it's going to sound like this, okay? So this review was posted January 25th, 2020. It's from Chrissy Casanova, you know, Chris from Marmalade Music. I didn't tell him to post this. He just did it. But, you know, I mean, we're kind of like in business together. But this is just as an example of how this is going to go. So pretend that this is you who left, you the listener, who left a 5-star rating and then this review, okay? The review says, artistic, funny, and smart. 5 stars. I'm a fan. People Pleaser is my new favorite podcast. I really enjoy the connections Austin makes with his guests and how this isn't just another podcast where some friends got together to start a podcast, if that makes sense. There is an artistic touch here due to things like weekly original music, thought out and well-worded intros and outros to each episode. And overall, he's just an easy person to listen to. Highly recommend. Oh, Chris, that's so nice. Okay, so that's the first part. I read your review and then I review you back, all right? So this is what I would say. I'd say, okay, so Chris Bjorn is really cute. He's got really cute glasses and a really cute smile. He's a really cute dog dad to his dog, Roo. He's a really fun person to go on coffee dates with and to go out to the bar with, or go sing like karaoke with, or just kind of do anything with. He's a really good pal. He's a really fun person to go on road trips with. He's a great songwriter. One of my favorite songwriters in the whole world. You should go look up his music on Apple Music and Spotify. It's just so much stuff on there for you to listen to. He is like always releasing so much music. And he's got an amazing business that he started. He's entrepreneurial and hardworking and talented, and I love him. Okay, so that can be you, listener. You leave a 5-star rating and a review. I'm going to read it on the podcast, and then I'm going to like say a whole bunch of nice stuff about you. How cool is that? Yeah? You down? All right, go do it. Yeah? Okay, cool. I'm excited. Those were the two things. Thank you. We did it. We made it through them. Those were the two things, and now we're going to get to a really fun episode. Last week's episode was really heavy. This week's episode is really light and fun. I mean, we kind of go all over the place this week's episode. You'll see what I mean. But yeah, I'm really excited about the intro that I made for this week's episode. And yeah, you're going to see what I mean. And it's all happening right now.
Brother, I'm going to have a brother. I've always dreamed about having a brother. Brothers don't shake hands. Brothers got a hug.
If you're lucky enough to have a brother you get along with, that's one thing. If you're even luckier to have a brother who doubles as one of your best friends and closest confidants, that's another. I'm lucky enough to have two. And they're both just the best, and for very different reasons. My two big brothers couldn't be more dissimilar in many ways, but there are certain, let's call them genetic idiosyncrasies, that bind all three of us and make us quite recognizably linked. I've got a big sister too, and she's also the best, but I'm going to talk about her on a future episode. Right now, I'm focusing on that macho muchacho shit, that mysterious and hard to verbalize bond between brothers. Even more specifically today, I'm looking at my bond with my eldest brother, Adam. You'll catch on as you get to know the Archer siblings that our parents did indeed do that totally cheesy thing where they give all their kids matching initials. We're all AA with differences in the middle initial. I'm extra unique because my first name is actually William, so I win that little imaginary contest. Anyway, my brother Adam is one of my very favorite people in the world. He's an incredible role model and friend, and just one of my favorite people to talk to about anything and everything. He used to host a podcast called Mormon Expression that catered to an audience of mostly ex-Mormons who were hungry to dissect every little detail about life inside the church that Joseph Smith built. Going on his show as a guest and irreverently roasting Mormon culture and my wholesome Mormon upbringing was my first real taste of podcasting from behind the mic. So you can all thank him for giving me the itch that needed to be scratched by this podcast. I knew I wanted him on as a guest before I ever recorded a single episode of People Pleaser. We had plans to record in December of this last year when I was going to be home for the holidays. I sent him a text telling him to think about possible topics we could discuss, and he sent me back, no joke, about 30 different options. I told him to narrow it down, but honestly, it was hard for either of us to pick just one. He made a great case for why each one would make a great episode, and we even found ourselves getting into little mini discussions on many of the proposed topics just to test the waters and see if they could hold up for a full episode. In the end, I realized that boiling my relationship with my big bro down to just one random topic felt kind of weird. And that's not to say that that's what I'm doing with my other guests. I'm not boiling my entire relationship with these people down to a single topic. I'm just picking a topic I think they have a unique perspective on or a particular passion for and running with it. But with my brother, there's just a different kind of energy. My relationship with him is special. And since this is my show and I can do what I want with it, I figured I'd give him his very own special episode. So we didn't pick one of the many, many topics he suggested. Instead, we decided to do things a little differently. Because we don't live in the same state, and between being the president of a company and the father of four kids, he's a busy guy, and we don't get a whole lot of time to chat. So we decided to hit record and just go through as many of the proposed topics he had texted me as we possibly could until we either finished the list or just got bored. It wound up being 3 hours long, and halfway through I just decided to cut it into two parts. So that's what the show is this week. And this is part one. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in North Hollywood and my brother's basement in Cottonwood Heights, Utah, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today is part one of me and my big brother Adam Archer just, well, catching up. Well, I've never done this before. We've got a list of 20 things because we couldn't decide what to talk about. So, we've got like 90 minutes to just see how many we get through. I mean, what is that? 20? How many minutes is that per topic if we go 90 minutes?
I think it's like 25 minutes per topic.
No, that doesn't make sense.
Hey, I haven't taken a math class in over 20 years.
That's really bad math.
No, let's see, 20 times four?
4 minutes?
4 minutes, 10 four? Seconds, something like that? 4 minutes, 20 seconds? I don't know.
Well, obviously, I don't think we're going to get through the list, but we'll try to encapsulate where our brains are at in this current moment right now on these things. So I think the two of us are people who have had a lot of evolution on all these things in our lives. We've never had like one set paradigm that defines these things for us. It seems to be constantly evolving. But it's always interesting to check in and say, where are you at on this? So we're starting off with a really easy one, nice and light, over the plate, simple softball topic, death.
Okay. You know what the irony of that is when I did my podcast 3 years, not my podcast, but when I did the podcast, like 3-4 years ago, that was,
it was first, transferred to you. It was,
yeah. Yeah. When I was administrating the podcast,
you were the steward of the,
but that was the first episode that I did. And I look back on it and I was trying to set the stage. This is just like a really difficult concept for people to understand. Clearly it's difficult for me to talk about because I don't think I did a good enough job. But there's this.
Do you ever feel like you said everything you could say or said it all perfectly?
Sometimes. I do. Sometimes I'm like, well, that was actually really good.
I think that's exactly what I was trying to say. I think that there's always like an amalgam of like what I'm trying to say, but it always ends and I'm like, you think that an hour is plenty of time to say all the things you can think of to say, especially if you've been trying to go in prepared, but there's always more that could be explored. And that's
sure.
Yeah.
That's life. You know, you go to bed every single night and you don't get everything done. There's the next day and you just pick right back up where you left off. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there's a psychotherapist named Irvin Yalom. I don't know if the W's a V in his name or if it's actually a V. I can't remember. But he wrote a book called Staring Into the Sun, and it was introduced to me by one of my friends who's now he has his PhD in psychology, and he's a professor down in Texas. But the idea of staring into the sun is that after his 50-year career of working in group therapy, the number one thing that he saw as a common variable between his patients was that the avoidance of our fear of death is like the biggest contributor to our mental instability. And so the wording, you know, the name of the book, it's a great metaphor, staring into the sun. It hurts to stare into the sun.
Well,
it'll burn your eyes. It'll blind you.
You can't. You're not supposed to do it.
Correct. And so it's kind of asking the same question: is metaphorically speaking, is fixating on death, or even thinking about your death, or addressing your death, is it like staring into the sun? Will it burn your eyes and scorch you to and maim you even? And
or is it possible to go into that difficult reflection and come out on the other side with a resolved state of mind about it?
Certainly,
you know.
Or even it could be asking it could be saying that staring into the sun in this instance is it's almost like a superpower. Like once you have faced death and you have addressed it head on, you can do things like staring into the sun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with the. I guess the hypothesis of the book is that, I mean, I've been talking about this a lot the last couple of days, that we all know it's just, we all know that it's an immutable fact of life, death, and we all know that it's coming for us, and we all know that it's coming for our loved ones, and we all live with this knowledge, but then every time it happens, it's such a strange state of surrealism. It just doesn't feel real, even though it's so clearly just, it's just one of the things that happens. It's just one of the, you know, it's just a part of the experience.
It's been an absolute essential piece of existence since the beginning of time. There's no one that has gotten out of this without having to die.
But every time
to this point,
but every time it happens to someone you know or love or are close to, it just feels like that can't be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now, like I'm constantly in this kind of weird state of like, but he can't be dead. He can't. My friend died a few nights ago, and it's just like, but he can't be dead. He's dead for like right now. He's dead, but like I'm gonna call him next week, and he's gonna like he's coming back.
Yeah.
But it's like no. He's not. That's it. Yeah, he did the thing.
This is permanent.
He did the thing. I'm gonna watch other people do it. You know, mm-hmm. Either you're gonna see me die, or I'm gonna see you die. One of those two things is gonna happen. Unless we both die on a plane or something like that, that we're both on.
Yeah, death is, it's, since my time working in hospice from 2009 to 2012, Austin and I and our father and then our brother Anthony, we worked kind of in a family business together and running and administrating a hospice. And we had the most wonderful and lovely patients, and their family members were amazing. And it was just this incredible experience, very taxing, very emotionally taxing, very difficult. There's wonderful people that work in that industry, and they really are. They're saints on planet Earth that are able to stand in that fire time and time and time again, watching people die. I mean, it's a surreal experience.
Do you think that in a way is like people who've learned to stare into the sun? People,
I think, to a degree.
I mean, there's people like our Uncle Scott who his whole career has been, you know, gathering bodies for organ donations. And do you think that to a certain degree do you think he's at peace with that part of life?
I've never asked him, but if you were to ask me I think so. I think in order to be able to dissect the human body again and again and again and treat it as truly what it is, a vessel, a vehicle for something, for some force of animation, your brain has got to be wired in a sense that you can separate the, you know, you can separate the spirituality from being human.
And then here's the funny thing, though, because even a person like that who has learned and trained over an entire career to separate out their personal, I guess, emotional attachment to life or the vessel or spirituality, mm-hmm. and just view it as this is just my job and I'm harvesting the vessel so that someone else can have a life. Even a person like that who's had a front row up in personal seat, if his daughter dies tomorrow, in a freak accident, he's not going to just be like, oh, well, you know, I've learned that this is just a thing that happens. It's going to wreck him.
Well, and I think that's compartmentalization. Yeah. You know, that's kind of, I was going
to, not to be too morbid about it,
but I was going to make that point with hospice where, you know, after working in hospice that intimately and being by people's sides as they took their final breath. And it wasn't, I mean, it was dozens and dozens of people. And it was a really strange experience to have for a young, you know, I was in my late 20s and early 30s when we had the business. And certainly I've been different since that experience. My view of death has been different. My ability to look at it objectively and from the outside looking in has definitely shifted, where I don't get nearly as emotional about it, but I totally agree with you. That's when it's not happening to me on a very personal level. Right. When it's if and when it was one of my children, I have so much respect for people. And I've had a number of people in my life, unfortunately, who have experienced the death of a child or who are experiencing the physical demise of a child. And I look at them and think, I don't know how you're functioning at even a relatively normal pace, or how you haven't just completely come unhinged. And I have so much respect for those people, because I don't think I would do that well. Mm-hmm. Even if I can compartmentalize and look at other people's deaths objectively and say, oh yeah, you know, everybody dies and it's just a part of life and it's something that I too will experience someday. I don't think you really, it's just so much different when it's intimate, when it's your spouse, when it's your child, when it's your parent. I mean, I'm seeing it with my wife right now, and six, seven months ago, her father just passed away suddenly and unexpectedly. And I literally don't know what she's going through. Mm-hmm. No matter how much I try to be there for her and support her and
help her. I'm terrified of what she's going to
it's going to happen to us.
One of my biggest fears. And I just try to just go, I'll just put that off because I can't even, I'll just take it when it happens. Yep. And it'll be awful. Don't we want it to be awful? I mean, do we want to get to a point where we're the cult from Midsommar and we just view death as this beautiful thing, and we all gather together and we go, and it's lovely, we're going to throw a party and they're going to jump off a cliff and we're all going to celebrate and cheer. And it's like, but don't we want to be kind of wrecked by the death of our loved ones?
Yeah, I mean, it's the movie Shadowlands, the C.S. Lewis story, you know. Mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis, he married this woman who was terminally ill and she had a son. And they really just got to spend a little bit of time together as a family. And he basically went into a relationship with someone whose life was going to be short. And he knew that from the get-go. And his takeaway from the experience is that death is the price of joy. You know, I can't remember exactly how he words it, but he says that's the price. You know, loving someone, the price of loving someone and feeling that elation and feeling that connection with another person, the price of that is that you're going to lose them someday. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just the way that we've come to describe it in the human experience, because currently at this time in our human evolution, mortality is still a constant, and we haven't figured out a way to transcend the, you know, the 72 to 75 year average lifespan of humans. But there may be a day in the future, who knows, 100 years from now, 50 years from now, where people don't have to die anymore, and where technology will physically, spiritually, emotionally, mentally prolong our lives to the point where we don't have to experience.
What's that going to do to us? I mean, what and that changes the entire changes the entire meaning of what it means to be alive.
Exactly.
What it means to be human. It's going to literally, in the same way that connecting the entire species through the internet did, you know, which we're living through the very, 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 very dawn of that. And still we're all right in the middle of coming to terms with what it's doing to the species. Something like that, I think it could happen. And we would all just sort of see it initially as like, isn't it so cool that we can do this? But it would probably take us a while before we'd realize really what that means. For the species, you know, it would take a while before we'd start to see. It would probably take till the first person got to like 150 or 200 or 250 before we'd start going, boy, this sure is different. Yeah. this is a different thing than everyone that came before us did. And then, I mean, there's so much to go into with that, which is why I'm like, is that what we want? Is the goal to overcome death? I know that there's a lot of people right now working toward that goal. There are a lot of like smart people and scientists. There's people who are trying to biohack their bodies so that bodies don't deteriorate. There's people who are trying to like figure out if they can stop the process of aging and decay and death.
If you really, I'm not a scientist. Mm-hmm. I've never excelled in science classes. But there are people who are science experts and who make their living engaging in science and thinking about science every single day. And in the same way that I think about home building every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a worthy goal for someone who's in that realm, whose focus is mortality, is biology. I think that's a total worthy goal to go, let's try to hack this thing and make it so people can live longer. Because if there's a chance that there is nothing after this, that, you know, let's play devil's advocate and say that energy transfers. Let's even say that reincarnation is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And that we just come back as a tree or a squirrel or another person.
Mm-hmm.
But you just, your entire experience is
memory
ostensibly white.
Uh-huh.
Let's say that's a possibility. Then living is amazing. It's, mm-hmm. it's incredible. It's such an incredible
thing. Amazing anyway.
To be able to be conscious and to be able to look around. I mean, I was up in the canyon
amazing,
today.
If that's not the if this is the only thing, regardless of what happens.
I'm saying if that happens, it's incredible. If it doesn't happen and there's nothing, living is so, so, so incredible.
Oh, it's the greatest.
It's even more incredible.
Yeah.
If there's nothing after this and this is it.
And you get
this is the greatest gift that anything in the universe is given.
Yeah.
To be conscious and to experience family and love and friendship.
Yeah, it's insane.
And kindness and compassion and disappointment and betrayal.
So you're saying a limitation on your conscious time as this person, as this identity. And I tend to agree with you because every time I've considered the concept of eternal life or living forever in some kind of afterlife, mm-hmm. it's like, but wouldn't anything after a certain point become hell? Wouldn't any, even no matter how paradisiacal that place is, wouldn't it eventually become torturous to live in a place of just sort of eternal wheel spinning? And like, I mean, it might be for a millennia or an eon or an epoch, mm-hmm. Really amazing to grow and learn as many things as you can possibly grow and learn into about all the dimensions and all the far reaches of all that is, you know, in the entire multiverse of multiverses. It might be really amazing, but wouldn't you eventually in the span of forever reach a point
that's my greatest existential fear.
Yeah.
It's the first time that I really noticed that I had a real deep existential problem with the religion that we were being raised in. I was in my mid-20s, probably laying in bed, trying to fall asleep at night. And my mind started wandering to the eternities and, you know, living with my family and living with my friends. What's it going to be like? And then I just allowed my mind just to keep going and keep going and keep going. And I got so paralyzingly scared by that thought exercise because I thought, what am I going to do forever? Like, what if I just get to a point?
And the answer is always like, you'll know. It'll make sense.
But what if I get to a point where I just don't want to do it anymore, but you've opted in and you have to live forever? That sounds like a nightmare. I think, but as you were just describing that, I think when we think of a thought, where we engage in a thought exercise like that, it's fear. It's our fear that is manifesting itself when we say, well, naturally, wouldn't you get tired at some point? And I think the response to that, the logical response to that, or the defense of that is, well, if life itself, if just being alive is better than not being alive, then maybe if being alive is a one and not being alive is a zero, then maybe being alive forever, even if it gets difficult at times, or you get frustrated at times, or sometimes you just get tired of being alive forever, mm-hmm. it's still better than not.
Yeah, some value is better than no value.
Yeah.
Some quantity, something is better than nothing.
Yep.
And yeah, I absolutely can imagine a potential eternal existence where you become so evolved and so transcendent that you learn ultimate presence and ultimate where you are always constantly centered and constant, you know, and your life is just kind of an overflowing abundance of love and peace and tranquility and serenity. And you are serenity and peace and love incarnate. And you, and am I, you know, I mean, and then people, the pessimistic and the fear goes, but wouldn't even that become at some point enough that you go, I've been present and effervescent in this flowing vessel of love for now, 800,000 years. And I think I'm good.
I think I'm done.
And then it's like, but the second that that happens, the second that you think, I think I'm done. If there was this plane of existence where there is no way out, now that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
There's got to be an off switch, which I think
that's my condition for heaven is I would only willingly opt into any version of heaven if I had control of the off switch. So. Yeah. Because that's scary too, thinking that someone else is in. That's part of what's scary about being mortal, is your life to a degree feels like it's outside of your control. Yep. That anyone, that some god or some force, the universe, something that's bigger than us can intervene in our lives at any time and stop our heart, have us walk right into a bus, have a 9.5 earthquake start and swallow us whole.
Well, you've heard about, I mean, I'm sure you've heard Sam Harris talk about free will and about how he doesn't think free will exists. Mm-hmm. But then I think that's so funny as for a person who's an atheist and a famous atheist thinker, if he doesn't believe in free will, what does he believe, or who or what is pulling the strings? I get where the logical, what he's talking about when he goes, if I ask you to name three movies, you can quickly name me three movies, but you can't tell me why those three movies are the first three movies that popped into your head. Mm-hmm. There might be, even if I asked you to explain why are those the three movies that you thought of, you could go, oh, well, those are, I mean, I'll list all these anecdotal reasons why those might have been, but it's still like there's some kind of functionality to your brain and to the process of what thoughts come to the forefront that you're not consciously controlling. At least you're not consciously controlling it. So the thought of, as far as like you, the person that you imagine in the driver's seat that's walking you through your, that's brushing your teeth, that's doing all this stuff, there's more to it that's pulling strings and allowing you the illusion of driving. But then I don't know, to that I'm like, but maybe there's just a lot of unconscious work going on as well that's still me. Mm-hmm. So it's still technically my will, or I don't know. But
I think your point with Sam Harris, I think there's a lot of people who, and this is my opinion of most of the world's prominent atheists. Mm-hmm. I think that there is, and I think there's a misconception of what atheism means to begin with. I think most people, when they hear someone's an atheist, they think that of somebody who's angry at God or who's furious with God, so mad at God that they refuse to believe in him, her, it.
Well, it's that straw man that you see in movies like God's Not Dead and stuff like that, where it's like, that's not.
I think the type of atheism that Sam Harris, if indeed that is how he identifies.
I think that's a title that's more ascribed to him.
Yes. And it's for simplicity. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. I fall into the atheist camp, but I think generously most times when someone says that they're an atheist and they're a very well thought out person, intelligent person, mm-hmm. I view them as someone who is living a life without God, mm-hmm. atheism, asymmetry
right.
is lack of symmetry, asexuality, a lack mm-hmm. of sexuality, right. mm-hmm.
Without at least a traditional conception of God, mm-hmm. like I do not ascribe to any dogmatic depiction or narrative of like a messianic figure.
And it's not even necessarily that it's because of any moral creed or faith basis. It's just not useful.
Yeah.
It's the idea of personifying, anthropomorphizing God is not useful to our human experience. So I'm going to choose to live a life
or to that person's.
Yeah, to that
because
person's.
Because I think that there are people who find it incredibly useful to just go, oh, I don't really care whether or not I'm, this is the way I wish all believers would behave. Mm-hmm. I wish that they would just adopt the attitude of, oh, I don't really care whether or not I'm literally correct.
Right.
I just know that it's useful for me to have this kind of relationship with a spiritual higher connection to something else. And I call it this, and it's useful for me,
And I don't think the average atheist that has been an atheist yep. And has thought about their position has any problem with the average religious person who approaches religion in that way.
Right.
This is useful for me. Great.
Yep.
Congratulations. Fantastic. And living a life without God, I'm asking for the same reciprocity. It's useful for me to live a life without God. If it works for you, that's fantastic. I think where atheists and you know, at their very core, atheists and religious people who are devout and true believers, where they butt heads is that typically atheists are frustrated with the behavior of those believers, that they impose their will and their beliefs on others, and then they treat them accordingly. And atheists and then religious people are threatened by atheists because they feel like their lack of belief threatens the strength of their belief. When in reality, like, whether or not someone believes the same thing as you should not change your belief in any way. Yeah, a belief is very personal.
It's actually it's always so funny to me how fragile people's beliefs can be when they claim that their beliefs are ironclad, but then the slightest bit of scrutiny, even just knowing that someone else finds their beliefs silly or yeah. or unfounded and finds no evidence in their beliefs is like can be really threatening to them, which is like why do you, if your belief is really so strong, then you shouldn't give a shit what I think of it. I'm going to say this right now. We're doing horribly.
Are we still on death?
Yeah, I think we've moved off. I think we added one to the list. We got into atheism and into, but that is one of the things on the list. It's further down the list. I'm going to move us along on the list.
And your show.
I knew that we would be horrible at this. I knew that the second we got onto one thing, I'd go, well, now I just want to talk about this. Because I think we could just talk about death, and then we could just talk about how that pertains to different conceptions of what life even is, what it even is to be alive. And if we get through the list, which I don't know if we will, I've got simulation theory on there, so we could, you know, talk about what even the conscious experience is. But I'm going to move us off the heavy topic of death and just move us into something a little bit lighter, divorce.
Divorce, the death of relationships. Yep.
So you were talking earlier about the price of joy is death. And I mean, you know, I think that it's interesting, our conception of divorce or even just any time a relationship ends, that to always have this very like fatalistic view of it, like this, it's this failure or this like, you know, yeah, this death or this cataclysmic thing. And it is very sad and it is upsetting when something doesn't work out. But also it's like that Louis C.K. joke where he's like, oh, trust me, no good marriage ever ended in divorce.
Yeah.
So, you know, but you have up close personal experience with this. We talked about the movie Marriage Story that came out this year. We, you know, talked a little bit about this, but you've been front row seat. What was your experience with that?
Yeah. I mean, watching that, that movie was fascinating because I was like, oh, okay. It's probably going to be nominated for an Oscar. I was hearing some buzz or something. And we were laying, my wife and I are laying in bed watching it. And there was just, I mean, every single beat of that movie was experience that. Yep. That too. I mean, the arguments, the way that they were trying to be respectful of one another, but then still frustrated. And, but there was, I was left with this real longing after watching that, where I think the death of a relationship that is that intimate, or not even necessarily the death of the relationship, but the evolution of a relationship. I don't think divorce always has to be a death. It doesn't have to be, we are never going to speak to one another ever again. Mm-hmm. We're never going to see each other ever again. And we're never going to appreciate or love one another ever again. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has to be that way.
Certainly not.
And I think they do a really good job of illustrating that in the movie, where they are still, regardless of how difficult it has gotten, and both of the people in the story, and this is in reality, you know, there's two sides to the story. Both people are experiencing, they're experiencing two things. They're experiencing the shared experience, and then they're experiencing their own experience, and
which is happening in a relationship anyway.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And divorce is no different. The only difference is that once you start heading down that road of getting divorced, the shared experience and that bond is no longer as strong. And so you start having more of your own individual experiences before you're completely separate. And that's where it gets really dicey. But I was so...
They have the thing in the movie of him sleeping with the stage manager and she's like, you know, she's all mad at him. I saw your emails, but he's like, I was sleeping on the couch when that happened. So it's like, yes, we were technically, we were still married, but like we were, things were on...
Were rough.
We were sort of agreed that we were heading toward the inevitable.
Yeah. And it's, and when they describe that scenario, I mean, there's millions of, tens of millions of married people that would be able to relate to that experience. And both sides have a valid point. I mean, she's not wrong in expecting that her husband will be faithful to her, even if he's sleeping on the couch. And he's not wrong either by feeling jaded and feeling pushed away. I mean, that's, both people are having their own separate experience and they're having valid feelings. And unfortunately, you know, as there's a rift in the relationship, that shared experience and that shared bond weakens. So, but the thing that I was just most envious of is, and that I'm so proud of some people for being able to do is maintaining a level of civility and care and concern for one another after the relationship comes to an end.
Because not everyone gets that.
No, not everyone does get that. I mean, I haven't gotten that. Yeah. And despite my best efforts and I know I've made a lot of mistakes, you know, I haven't done everything. I didn't do everything right when I'm married and I haven't done everything right since I've been divorced. I'm sure of that, but I know that my heart is in the right place. I know that deep down inside, I am at a place where not even deep down inside, just inside, I'm at a place where I want us to get along. I want us to be able to speak to one another in a tone just like this. I want us to be able to disagree with each other and to not make it personal and not make ad hominem attacks at one another. And I know that that's where I am. That's what I want. Because our children are 11 to 19 years old. We're going to be in each other's lives for a long time. This animosity and this frustration towards one another and this lack of civility, it's not helping anyone. It's not helping me. It's definitely not helping our kids. I mean, there's no question about that. So, yeah, I was really grateful for that movie and depicting that the process of divorce is difficult. And I think that's just intrinsic because something's coming to an end that you really cared about for whatever period of time. But it's really nice to see that there are, and it's not just in the movie. I've got so many examples in my life of people, close friends, you know, Pat, who you just did an episode with recently, you know, he and his wife are so kind to one another and his ex-wife, she's since gone on and gotten remarried and she's had two more children with her current husband. And they do such a good job. They can go to shared events. They can go to the kids' birthday parties together. Pat will babysit her kids for her. And it's just a really beautiful thing to see. And I can admit, you know, I'm jealous of that. I wish I had that.
Well, you know, I just got done talking with my friends, Alicia and Camille as well. And we were talking about sort of the story of their company and what it takes to be successful and investing in yourself and believing in yourself. But I, in the middle of it, I said, I think I'd be remiss though, if I didn't mention in all of this, the aspect that luck plays and that it is great when you have a person who can handle the business end while you handle the artistic end. Not everyone can find that collaborator to work with, you know, and all these things that you found the right space for the right price and you found the, you know, and all these things. And I think that's the same thing in what you're going through is, there's an aspect of it of whenever you're involving other people or need, what is all of this? You have a new, why did I have my phones on airplane mode and my computer, hey, whatever. My computer does it. Yes. Makes a little ding noise so it can interrupt me talking. Yes. But you can't control what other people are going to do. And I'm responsible in any relationship that I'm in for 100% my part. And so that means taking accountability for all of my part and doing my work to improve on the things that I am deficient in and recognize my character defects and recognize where I went wrong and what my mistakes were and wherever possible to try to make amends with the people that I wronged, if they'll hear it and if they'll have it. But up to a certain point, there's only so much that you or anyone else can do. And I think that I 100% agree with you. I think that, you know, in the relationship and the coming to a place of not being able to move forward, you could say, hey, look, we both had a part to play in this. It takes two to tango. But my personal opinion is that post-relationship in the divorce, I think you've made it very clear that your intent is, if for no other reason than for our kids, we need to figure out a way to be friends.
Yeah.
And but that's something you can't force someone yeah. else to do.
Yeah.
And that's what's so difficult. And it's not to villainize, because people also heal in different ways. And, you know, my partner right now just recently reconciled with her partner before me. And it was very good for her, and she got a lot out of it. And he lives in California, mm-hmm. and they like went out to lunch, and she said, you can come if you want. I said, no, I think you should just go talk to him. And they now, like, they've hung out a couple times since then. They like have like, he's like invited her to parties and stuff like that. And I think it's really good. But she also has said, she goes, I needed that time away from him. Mm-hmm. I needed to block him on Instagram. And, you know, and there's certain people who they feel like it's going to be more beneficial for them to have that. I had in my last relationship in the breakup, it was the first time that I went, I actually have to block this person because I can't see their stuff in my yeah. feed right now. It's dragging me backwards in my healing process. Every time I see them, I'm no longer in that space. And when I see this person, I'm always very happy that they're doing well. And my ex is she's engaged mm-hmm. and I'm thrilled for her and I wish them all the best. But that's what I always hope with those relationships, is that you can come to a place where you see each other and honor the affection that was there. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why
it didn't work.
But also there's a reason why we had a family together. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why we had three kids.
Yeah.
There's a reason why we did this for 13 years. And it's not because we just fucking hate each other. There's a lot there. Mm-hmm. There's a big foundation of mutual respect
sure.
and mutual admiration. And it's really hard to see that when it looks like there's no hope of that mm-hmm. returning. And in some relationships, when there's been abuse, physical or verbal, sometimes it really makes sense to have that hard separation of we will never see each other again if there's danger involved. But it is unfortunate when it just seems like it's just an emotional blockage.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's hopeless, and I don't think that in your case, there's no hope of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Like you said, there's many years to go.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thought exercise, though, because as time goes on, and as the difference between divorce and friendships is if you were in a toxic enough friendship, you could just stop communicating with that person.
Mm-hmm.
You can move states. You cannot answer their phone calls. You cannot return their emails. There's a number of ways that you can just kind of gracefully step outside of a friendship. But in divorce, you can't, especially if you have kids.
Mm-hmm.
You have to continue to be confronted by that other person.
Right.
And so there's this, you don't get that luxury of having distance, mm-hmm. you know, like you just described with Mary, being able to step away for a while and to come back to this person and see them through a different lens. So it's just hard. It's been 4 years for me, and I'm going, I've never had a troubled relationship for 4 years, just constantly troubled for four yeah. years. So it's hard to, if I'm being vulnerable, it's tough to stay hopeful, and it's tough to not give up on that other person, because I can say in my heart of hearts, and I can't speak for her. I just can't. She's got her own experience. She's got her own thoughts on the process, but I want nothing but the best for her. And that doesn't mean me providing the best for her. We're not married anymore. Mm-hmm. But I want her to go out and I want her to be with someone who makes her feel like her best self and brings out the best qualities in her. I want her to feel protected and comforted and loved. And I want her to have someone to love. I want her to succeed in her career. Mm-hmm. I want her, for her, not for me, not because it makes things easier on me, but because it builds her up and it makes her feel better about herself. And I just don't know. I really don't know if she wants those same things for me, you know? And that could be where the disconnect is I can honestly say, you know, even though I'm not perfect and I don't always respond to everything in the way that she would like me to, that is my intent. And that is where my heart is. I really do. I'm so happy in my life now with my wife. And this is the other side of divorce, but people talk about the hard stuff. There's a lot of awesome stuff about being divorced too. A lot of awesome stuff.
Well, that's my next topic is second marriages. So we can get into that if you want
to. Dude, like I am telling you, it was to go from, that was probably the scariest thing that I've ever experienced personally, mm-hmm. where you can see in real time the wheels coming off your car as you're driving it.
Yeah.
And to go, well, I'm just going to either get run over by a semi because I don't have wheels on my car and I'm just sitting in the middle of the freeway. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to have another car again because I just ruined my car. There's all these.
I don't know if I ever want to get
if I ever want to get in another car again because that was scary as hell.
How the hell do you get the courage and the the temerity to Annie back up after such a traumatic ordeal? Because I see you see it all the time, mm-hmm. that people kind of quickly find the next partner, mm-hmm. because especially if you've been in a long 10 plus year marriage, being alone is hard after that, and you sort of become grown accustomed to a partnered life. Was there a lot of trepidation and fear heading into
I think
number two?
If I asked Adam from 10 years ago or even Adam from 5 years ago, I'm almost certain if you asked him, would you get married again if your relationship came to an end? First, I'd have to give the caveat. I don't think Adam thought that his relationship was ever going to come to an end. We don't come from a long family lineage of divorces.
Yeah.
This is new for the Archer line and for the Westcott line. There's been a couple here and there, but it's the minority, definitely not the majority.
I can't think of one.
On the Archer side, yes, yeah. but you know, we've had a couple cousins who have gotten divorced, yeah. but it's the minority, not the majority. So I always said, I would never, ever, ever sign up for this again. And I've recently said this to Lisa. I am so grateful to myself that I listened to me and not what everybody else was telling me to do. Mm-hmm. And I can say that hindsight being 2020, because I'm very happy right now. I'm the happiest I've ever been in my entire
including,
life.
Including, I think, me. I was like, hey, how about take it easy?
Yeah. Everyone, anyone that cared about me, yeah. You, Brandon. I mean,
and it wasn't because we don't love Lisa.
No.
And it wasn't because we don't think
you're
that
worried
she's awesome.
About me.
It was just, take it easy.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it is one of those things where the more that you go through this, and this has been my experience, is like, I keep getting closer to knowing what it is I'm looking for, mm-hmm. and believing that it's okay to expect
yeah.
that yeah. rather than to go, I think I'm just going to have to settle for what I get and be happy. Mm-hmm. I think it's okay to go, no, actually I'm learning from these people, mm-hmm. who I am and kind of what it is that I'm looking for. And then if you find it again, that thing of luck, you could have been out there dating for 2-3 years looking for it, but I think you just met this person and went, yeah, but that's it. And I'm good to go.
Well, I was very intentional about the process. So, my ex-wife said to me, like, probably sometime in the last 2 years before Lisa and I were married, but she made this side comment. I don't think she even meant anything by it, but she just said, you know, gosh, you're so lucky that you met someone without children. Cause this has been really hard. She's with a guy who has three kids. And mm-hmm. so then they've got the combination of their kids and it just adds all this complexity. And my response to her was, oh, you think that's luck? yeah, there's an element of it that's luck, but I was also, this was all very intentional. And this was part of the process was, and why I say I'm proud of myself for listening to myself. When I got divorced, it wasn't, again, it wasn't expected. Did we have a perfect relationship? No, we had all kinds of problems for years and years and years. But since we didn't come from that lineage of divorce, it was never
a line of working through it.
Fidelity. It, yeah. You're staying in the pocket, even when it's hard.
We're going to find a way through this.
And so that's just, I just never allowed my mind to go there. So mm-hmm. in that sense, it was unexpected for me.
Yeah.
But even though it was traumatic and it was hurtful and it was shocking, I knew for me that I needed to keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. That's my personality. I don't do well when I stand pat and I just build up the fences and say, I'm just going to protect myself here in this zone. I thrive when I'm constantly trying to be better. And so I was really genuinely worried that if I stood still and a year went by, 2 years went by, 3 years went by, and I justify it to myself that I'm working on me, or I'm going to play the field. I'm going to just date and learn different things about women and really get to know what I want. I already knew what I wanted. You know, yeah. I'm deep in family. My oldest is 15 years old. My youngest was 7 at the time. I want a family. I want to give to these children the same thing that our parents gave to us. The hope that the human experience and that family is worth it.
It does kind of hamper your ability to go out and be a bachelor for several years when you've got 4 kids at home and you're like, I can't just have a revolving door of dad's girlfriends for the next 4 years.
You can. This isn't to demean people that are able to do that.
Yeah.
For me, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I would not have been able to maintain that separation and that balance in my life.
Yeah.
And so I was very assertive and very purposeful from the very beginning that this is scary. I'll acknowledge that I'm scared. I'll acknowledge that I'm worried that this isn't going to work out and that I'm going to make a mistake and that I'm going to hurt someone, but it's worth it. Kind of like the C.S. Lewis quote we were talking about earlier from the movie. This is the price. Like if you want connection, if you want a shared experience with someone, if you want someone to help you raise your children, if you want a good example for your children, for a mother to mentor them and to give them a different perspective on life and to fill them with love, that's the price you have to be willing to pay, that it may not work, you may get hurt.
Do you think that there's been a perspective shift from first marriage, I'm never even going to consider the possibility. I'm never even going to consider the possibility that divorce is even an option. We're going to work through it no matter what it is. To now second marriage, I know full well that divorce is a reality and that it is that it's not just up to me and that all of my, you know, being determined and trying to will my life into existence can't make life do what I want it to do. Mm-hmm. That things don't always go according to my plan. Do you think that maybe helps to actually go, since I know that if I'm not careful, I could lose this.
I'm surprised by this in myself, honestly. I absolutely thought that would be the case. And I mm-hmm. thought I would go into marriage again and I would be jaded.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just kind of reserve this piece of myself that was a shield that's at the ready to protect myself from the pain that uh-huh. I could potentially experience again. And Lisa and I were just talking about this like 3 or 4 nights ago, and it was such an interesting realization for me. And that was that I don't ever think that we're not going to make it. I don't ever even entertain, like the thought doesn't even come into my mind that she and I won't make it.
Mm.
Whereas in my previous marriage, even though I was raised in a paradigm where divorce was not the first option, second option, or third option,
yeah.
It's still, and as we were talking about it, all this this flood of memories came back to me of just the countless times where I would notice my mind slipping into that space where I would be going, I don't know if we're going to make it. Like this thing feels so out of control and it feels like we're just not ever lining up on the same page. How can we keep doing this forever? And it was a really satisfying experience to to talk to Lisa about this and to realize I'm not experiencing any of that with her.
Where, that's really wild.
Where we're having, we're in a relationship. She gets annoyed with me sometimes. I get annoyed with her sometimes. But I don't ever, nothing has happened to the two of us in the last year and a half. And people may be listening to this and like, just wait. The reason I can say this with confidence is I was experiencing this week one of my last relationship, mm-hmm. where it was just fighting from the get-go and miscommunication from the get-go. 3 months in, her going, maybe we should get divorced.
And you made that work for 13
years.
And
I made it work for 13 years. And I'm a year and a half in, and the thought isn't, it has never crossed my mind because I really value and appreciate who my wife is. I was very purposeful in seeking her out and in pursuing her. And she, to me, in return. I mean, she had her reasons for wanting to be with me, and I had my reasons for wanting to be with her. And we took our time. You know, I definitely rushed into it right after my first relationship.
She just really wanted a guy with four kids.
She is the craziest person.
Four grown kids.
Yeah. But we took our time. We dated for 2 years, which is in our culture standards is forever. You know, I mean, we're used to where we grew up, people get married after 2-3 months of knowing each other. So right. We got to know each other then, but I'm thrilled. I am thrilled with where our relationship is. But to answer, to kind of bring this full circle and answer your question, the place where that knowledge that things can end, where it is most helpful in this current relationship is, I think it absolutely makes me more present and more grateful and more appreciative for what I have right in front of me, and to not overlook how important that is. And I know I had a tendency to do that in the past.
That's not the answer I expected too. Cause I wasn't even trying to say from like, I was like, maybe you're jaded, but just a thing of like, oh, now that I know that that's part of it, maybe, but I think that's really fascinating to have that new experience of you're coming back to the, it doesn't enter into my, or like still sure that you're going to make it, but from a different place of, it's not that I'm fighting through the doubt. It's that the doubt's not even there. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting. Yeah, I don't think I've ever experienced, or at least in my adult life, I've never experienced faith mm-hmm. Of that magnitude.
I said that. Daunting. I said that to my to Lisa at our wedding. Though, you know, I don't know if you recall my vows. They were pretty long, but I meant it. And this was bizarre for me to even be able to say this because it just hasn't been part of my adult experience. And that's the idea of hope, and not just the idea, but being full of hope. And that was the biggest thing that my wife. The biggest transformation that I've experienced in my life with being with Lisa is that she fills me full of hope. Life's not, I know that we're still mortal. I know that we're going to have problems, but for the first time in my life, I am living not just with a small portion of hope. It's not just 10% of the cup. It's more than half of the cup. And that's a really satisfying feeling. You know, even if hope is just delusional, it's such a powerful force that it gets us up in the morning and it gets us to the gym and it gets us focused on hobbies that would be beneficial for us. And it hope gets us to turn our attention from ourselves and to put it on other people. Hope, you know, it helps us to balance out all of the white noise that there is in the world and mm-hmm. the politics and religion and expectations and it helps us to find peace and balance through all of that. And so I'm just really grateful for that. It may sound so trivial to someone else, but this is a new experience for me in the last few years. It's just being hopeful in my daily life.
Yeah, I've been experiencing that too in my life. I have a lot of hope. I have a lot of positive thoughts for my future and where I'm headed, and that used to not be the case. And it is incredibly powerful. And regardless of whether or not it's rational to think that I can will the results that I want into existence, it's not really about that. It's just about what it provides to me on a day-to-day basis mm-hmm. to live
Just the
in hope the rather than in fear. Yeah. The pragmatism of just being hopeful versus being fearful.
Yeah.
It's just a more peaceful way to live. Mm-hmm. It gives me relief from my depression and anxiety. I'm going to count that as hope because that's on the list.
Okay.
I'm going to count that. I'm going to check it off. So we got second marriages and hope checked off. I'm shifting gears big time now. So we're going to have to rewire our thinking caps and our...
I'm going to go over the top. I'm going to
turn around
the hat.
Knuckles over the top.
Because I become like a machine.
I need to watch that movie again.
Oh, dude. Classic. It's funny when you see movies as an adult where you're like, oh, that was fantastic. It was one of my favorite movies as a kid. And then you go back and read the history on the movie and it was just panned by the critics and everyone hated it.
Of course.
It was in the theater for 2 weeks.
It's an arm wrestling movie. it's Arnold Schwarzenegger. No, it's Sylvester Stallone. Is
Lincoln Hawk.
Is Lincoln Hawk a truck driving arm wrestler who
he doesn't live with his wife because his wife's dad is mean. He's rich and mean and keeps him away.
Robert Loggia is the dad. And at some point he drives his semi-truck through his father-in-law's house and comes and rescues his son. And it's like, no, you're going to jail. Of course. Like that, you're not heroic. Unstable.
Yes, he was going to go to jail, but then the grandfather uses that as an opportunity to get leverage over him and to get and he sees the opportunity to have Lincoln sign over his parental rights to his grandson Michael.
Holy shit! What an insane movie. Insane screenplay.
It's awesome. It's fantastic.
You know what was over the top? When you drove your truck through my house. That was over the top, dude.
Well, he has gates up.
Well, I can't get in there because you got the gates up. Sure, okay, you made it through the gates, but then you drove through my front door. Your car was up against my grand staircase.
Could you knock?
Could you knock? You made it through the gate. You can knock.
Oh,
that was a little over the top.
Well, it is, it was the 80s and everything was big and... Uh-huh. You know, Lisa and I were watching Predator the other night, and I hadn't seen that since I was 10 years old.
Oh.
And in the first 30 seconds of that movie, when Schwarzenegger and Carl Weathers...
Dylan, you son of a bitch!
And they hit their hands, and it just has a full 3-second bicep.
Also the sound effect of them clapping hands.
it's awesome.
The unapologetic machismo of that movie is... incredible.
We have progressed. I mean, Fast and Furious is the same vein as these B movie.
I'll never ever go with you on the Fast and the Furious things. I know you love those movies, but I watched Hobbs and Shaw. I went to the theater and it's not for me. And I know that it's thing as the MCU. I know that it's stupid, but I just am like, I just can't with all the...
See, in fairness, I think Hobbs and Shaw was definitely not for me either because it was lacking. It just had a little too little Vinny D.
Didn't have enough family.
Dude, Vinny D is the glue of those movies. They're family. So absurd, so stupid, so outlandish. I mean, they have become a superhero franchise when they started as guys who were just drag racing.
It's one of the most insane. Okay, we're skipping now to transformative films. We're going to talk about films a little bit since we're already doing it. So everyone knows we're on to films. But it's one of the most insane film franchises, I think, in the history of film. It's so crazy, the trajectory of, if you watch the first movie, it's just like this.
Just people.
It's just this heist movie.
Yeah.
It's just, there's these thieves that their kind of MO is they rob semi-trucks while they're on the road and they're really good stunt drivers. And then they moonlight as at night they drag
it's
race in
LA. It's a post-high school movie. It's about people who just graduated high school who are in that weird in-between time when they're like 18 to 22 and trying
they're
to
drag racing.
Life. They're living on their own for the first time.
And somehow at some point along the line they just decided this franchise isn't about drag racing anymore or even really about cars. Every episode now it still features at least at some point.
It's about saving the world.
It's about people who for no reason can punch through brick walls and can drive cars out of the back of planes and land them on mountainsides and drive down the mountainside in their car. It's the most insane progression.
Give me your top two. How many of the movies have you seen? Have you seen two or three?
Yeah, I think three. I saw Hobbs and Shaw, and I think I've seen the first two, and then I think I've seen Scenes.
So, what are your two most, your two favorite most insane moments from the Fast and Furious?
The craziest thing I've ever seen. I haven't seen the whole movie. The craziest thing I've ever seen in one of the movies is when Vin Diesel. You'll probably know which movie it is when he stomps on the pavement in that fight that he's having on the
because the street hits back.
Yeah, when you're at the street hits back, and he's fighting a guy on top of a parking structure, and there's been a lot of like structural damage to the parking structure during their fight because if I'm not mistaken, like them smashing into the ground has caused some cracks, and then
there was some machine gun fire,
and he stomps on a crack in the pavement, and he stomps on it so hard that the entire structure starts collapsing, and it's the most insane thing of like
that's definitely top three.
The power of Vin Diesel's stomp bringing down a parking structure,
and then the power of family and love brought him back to life from being crushed by a four-story parking structure.
Oh, and also, if I'm not mistaken, they have a whole episode where he's brainwashed or something like that, where he's like a bad guy because he gets like brainwashed. Is that right?
That was in Fate of the Furious. He was acting like he was brainwashed, but he was being blackmailed because they were going to take over the family. And so Vinny D had to turn against the family to save all of them.
So this category is supposed to be transformative films. We're just going to just say it's films. We're just, or maybe just insane films. Let's talk insane films for a second. Okay. So Fate of the Fear, the Furious franchise is one of the craziest.
It's the top of Mount Rushmore.
It's so crazy. Totally insane. But I have to say, so Mom and I just went and saw Cats, and there's a lot of conversation going on online about this right now. And Mom's like, oh, you liked it. You liked it. You're just saying you didn't like it because it's popular. Now, I grew up with the musical, and I always knew that it was not a great musical, but I just had kind of nostalgic fondness for it and the music. And I do think that it works as a purely piece of on stage as purely a piece of entertainment, much like if you went to go see a Cirque du Soleil show or like a ballet performance where you're like, I don't even know the story of this ballet. It's just nice to see the choreography and the imagery, and it's moving. And that's sort of how Cats is. It's just kind of these weird songs and like this very beautiful dancing and choreography and sets. But it's had three forms. It was a book of poems by C.S. Lewis. That was the first form, probably the most appropriate. Just a simple book of poems about different kinds of cats. Lloyd Webber decides to make it a musical. Weird. Not great subject matter for a musical, but okay. With enough money and enough talent on stage, it manages to be watchable. The least of these forms, what it most certainly is not, is a movie. And it was the most insane thing I think I've ever seen. The whole movie, I just thought, what was everyone thinking? What in the world was Tom Hooper thinking when he thought, that's gotta be
on a movie?
It's not a story. It's 2 hours of lists of different kinds of cats. And they just come out and like, I'm the fat cat. We're the mischievous thief cats. And then one's like, I'm the cat who everyone wants to fuck.
I read this article the other day that, and I haven't seen the movie yet, but I thought it was such a great description where they were trying to make an argument for it lasting as the test of time as a cult classic or a cult favorite movie. And the best that they could come up with is, I'm sure there will be a generation of drug users sometime in the future that will really enjoy it.
Oh, I think it absolutely could have a cult life for sure. I definitely, and look, I will say this as a nostalgic fan of the stage version, there are sequences that I did get a lot of pleasure seeing brought to life in the manner that it was brought to life. There's when they get to the Jellicle Ball, it's so insane. It's Jellicle cats at the Jellicle Ball to have old Deuteronomy choose one of the Jellicle cats.
It's insane on stage.
It's insane. But there's a wonderful dance sequence in the stage show when they get to the ball that's like a 15-minute long dance sequence that's just really beautiful. And the way that they did that in the movie, while it does nothing narratively, it was thrilling to watch. And there was a lot like that where there was, my biggest disagreement with the criticisms of the movie is that it looks freaky and weird. I thought it was beautifully captured I thought it was really stunningly shot. And I thought Tom Hooper did a wonderful job capturing the dance numbers. I just thought it was a damn shame that he chose to do this show of all shows. It's like, hey, Tom Hooper, you made Les Mis, make Miss Saigon. Like that's in the same vein as the, but Cats of all things. Another insane movie that was on TV right before I came over here, Batman and Robin.
Just unwatchable.
Matt married with Batman Forever. Those Joel Schumacher Batman
are so
movies
weird.
Are the most bizarre. That they gave him just $100 million mm-hmm. to make the craziest.
Basically, like to paint every costume in shiny nail polish. They are the most bizarre. Batman and Robin. I mean, there are the most wonderful YouTube videos breaking down just how terrible Batman and Robin is frame by frame. And it's not, they're it's not little 2 minute movies. They're 20 minute movies.
It's staggeringly terrible.
Yeah.
And just the dialogue of Arnold Schwarzenegger alone. I don't think he says a single line in the movie
that isn't a pun.
That doesn't have a pun in it. And it's like, they had to have been pulling all of our legs. Like, they had to have just been writing the screenplay like there's no way.
How does Schwarzenegger still speak with an Austrian accent?
Someone asked him that. A bunch of people asked him that.
It's got to be intentional at this point, isn't it? I mean, that's a long time to live in another country and you just... This is just very difficult to kick.
It's almost like he has a speech impediment. Like, they talked about... I think Jimmy Fallon asked him and Jimmy Kimmel asked him when he was promoting the latest Terminator movie. They were like, how is your accent still so thick? And he was just like, I was talking to Sly and I told him that this movie was coming out. And you're like, how do you...
It's got to be a shtick at this point.
I mean, I think celebrities do this sometimes. I think they sort of become caricatures of themselves. Yeah. And
I think Christian Bale is a great example. Like, what is his real...
I don't think he knows.
He probably doesn't know.
I don't think... Gary Oldman said before that he sometimes has a hard time remembering, like...
What his
accent is.
What his voice sounded like when he was 14 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know? You know how many different voices I do for my job? It's hard to remember who I am. Tom Holland even said that since he almost exclusively works with an American accent these days...
That's got to be bizarre.
Yeah, he said he was doing some commercial in the UK, and he was like promoting something, and he was like, "Hey guys, it's Tom, and I just want to make sure that." And they were like, "Tom, this is running in the UK. You can use your voice." And he was like, "Oh that's right." in his brain, he's like, "When I'm acting, I
got a Peter Parker.
I speak in a." It's so bizarre, but it's also no one's ever hired Arnold Schwarzenegger to not
be Austrian Arnold Schwarzenegger.
We have given him roles where his name is like Jack Slater, or we give him these roles where it's like that guy's name is not Jack Slater.
it's Jürgen Klinsmann.
Yeah, it's not that guy's name. And his name is always some I think his name's Dutch in Predator. Dutch? Is he? No, because Dylan is Carl Weathers. Dylan, you son of a bitch.
I love having been in the military, and you can, if you're born in another country, you can still serve in the United States military. I don't know what all the requirements are, but I remember guys in my platoon that were from Bosnia or, they were refugees at the time. But I love in movies when there'll be like a major or a colonel who's 34 years old and is from Germany. And you're going, let me get this straight. You moved to this other country and you've risen the officer ranks to the fifth or sixth rank in your short 10 years in the military.
He's a Green Beret mercenary.
It's like, just do a little bit of research. But it just goes to show how little the average viewer knows about how the military is actually structured. I know before I went into the military, I knew nothing about the military.
This one was on TV about 3 weeks ago. Street Fighter. You want to talk about Jean-Claude Van Damme as Guile, Commander Guile, who has an American flag tattooed on his bicep and is constantly talking about how we are going to go in and we are going to kick Bison's ass. And I am going to take
from Brussels.
He's from Brussels, Belgium. And he's Guile, the American the American GI.
Starring Raul Julia as M. Bison.
As M. Bison.
He plays him as Gomez Adams.
When he radios his friend and she goes, "Guile, are you okay?" And he goes, "No, I am only half dead." And she goes, "And Bison? All dead."
That's so awesome.
I am going to kick Bison's ass.
That is a perfect example. So he's from Belgium.
Why?
He's about 38.
Why did they cast him?
And he's a colonel.
Why of all the stars?
Because Guile was famous for that roundhouse kick that he would do, so they needed somebody with a wicked roundhouse. Chuck Norris was a little too old. He was probably 52, 53
at the time. Couldn't Jean-Claude Van Damme been one of the kung fu guys, that, like Kyle and Ryu?
Ryu and Ken. Yeah.
Couldn't he have been Ken? Because the Ken guy that they had in the movie has a pretty small part.
He's a very small part. And yeah. You also don't know what the ethnicity of Ken is. He's not in, like, the Japanese military.
But that's why Ken could have been a guy from Brussels. But then...
That is totally insane. Colonel Guile is the muscles from Brussels.
And he's got a really...
I'm only half dead.
And he's got an American tattoo on his looks like
a... They have that
shot of him uppercutting bison.
That's fantastic.
Also, it 100% looks like a press-on tattoo that you get from...
From a little egg.
The
little quarter
100%
machines.
100% looks
so,
like...
So, you were probably too young when we saw that movie in the theaters. That's one of my favorite... One of my favorite moving going experiences from our childhood was Dad took us to see it.
Yeah.
And he just, I can only imagine, since I'm his age now, when he took us to the movie, how painful that was for him to sit through. Hey, I've never played this video game. I don't play video games. I have no idea what this even is. And then it's just so absurd.
You know, that's kind of what Cats was like, is it's like you're trying to make a screenplay out of something that isn't a movie.
Yeah.
And that's what all those 90s video game adaptation movies mm-hmm. were, is like Mortal Kombat and all these things. Mm-hmm. It's like, this isn't a movie. This isn't a ABCD narrative. Yeah. This isn't a beginning, middle, and end narrative with clear-cut protagonists and antagonists. You're determining, based on nothing, who the heroes are and who the villains mm-hmm. are. There's nothing in the game Street Fighter that says that Guile is the main hero.
No.
He's just one of the characters. No. And there's nothing in...
He's not even the best character in the
game. He's not even the best character.
Not even close.
And there's nothing in the game Mortal Kombat that says that Liu Kang is the clear-cut protagonist of... There's nothing. Mm. But they just determine, and then they try to cobble together a screenplay based on the very loose information that we have from the video game. And that's the problem, is it's like, you can't just force something to be a movie.
I feel like, in fairness, though, doesn't Mortal Kombat work to a degree?
I mean, they
that
all...
That it's a mortal, it's a tournament that ends in each of their deaths that they lose.
But does it? Like, so, but why? All these people, this movie star, Johnny Cage, this cop and her partner, Sonya, and her friend, and, like, this random guy, Liu Kang, all get invited to this island to participate in... Why the fuck? Like, because the gods have this tournament and they invite... Like, why, though? And then there's also, like, four-armed monsters and
Goro claymation in that movie is... It stands on Mount Rushmore of claymation.
The way that they shoehorn
so
in...
Awesome.
You know, reptile, like the... Scorpion. Who are these guys? Yeah, like,
they're just demons from the nether world.
So, does it work?
I don't know if I've seen it since I was 12, so maybe it doesn't.
I highly doubt it stands the test of time with that whack-ass... like techno soundtrack that it had, you know, like, and I think it's a U-Bull movie too. And
who's U-Bull?
He's just a notoriously terrible filmmaker.
Oh, really?
Made lots of video game adaptation movies.
Did he make Mario Brothers too?
He did not. But that's another one that's one of the most insane movies ever made. Again. And I probably the one.
Do you think when they're acting in that, that they had a similar experience to Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill, where they're going, what in the hell are we in? But then maybe hoping, since Star Wars had come out and it was successful, maybe they're like, this could be good. I don't know.
I think that everyone, when they're in movies like that, like Batman and Robin or like Cats or now the Fast and the Furious people, I think they think that their movies are awesome because
they're they genuinely think their movies are good.
I think they have a blast making those movies. And I think that they love, I mean, first of all, they make a lot of money, but I actually think that those people, like, because a lot of them, that's all they have going on. I think that Tyrese puts everything that he's got into it.
Yeah.
And I think Vin Diesel, since it's kind of the only thing he has left, puts everything he's got into it. But I think that there's an experience that people who are in Cats and people who are, that they definitely have the Star Wars experience of, this feels really weird. And I feel like I have no idea whether this is good or not. I mean, it might be brilliant, but it also might be the worst thing ever. But I'm just going to not judge it. I'm going to collect my paycheck and I'm going to do my best, the best work I can do.
It's going to be really hard as an actor to turn that much trust over to so much back-end work. You can only do so much in the moment to deliver the scene and to deliver the emotion. And then afterwards, that scene where you thought you really just killed it, it may even be cut out of the movie entirely.
Film, more than any other medium that actors participate in, I mean, it's really stage and film. But I mean, whatever it is that you're doing as an actor, film is really out of your control. Unless you are an actor in the movie and a producer, yeah, and or you're acting in the movie and you also are the writer and director. Sure. If you're just a day player on a set, or even if you're have a pretty mm-hmm. significant role in a movie, they always say the movie's made three times: when it's written, when it's shot, and when it's edited. Hmm. And so almost none of those really include the actor as a collaborator on how we're going to do this.
Yeah, even when it's shot.
Even when it's shot, yeah, the actor kind of shows up and is told where to stand and what you're going to do. And you do your best job to use the tools that you have as an actor to sure. to make the scene, to make sure that you are not, you're trying to lean on your training and stuff like that. But still, I have no idea what the shot looks like. I don't know what the coverage is like. I don't know.
It's going to be hard. How wide is the shot? Is it in on my face? You have no idea.
And then I have no idea we do all kinds of setups. So we'll do close-ups. We'll do coverage just on me and then just on the other person. I have no idea how the scene's going to be cut together. I don't know which take they're going to choose. I don't know if the actor has so little control over it. You have to really trust the people who are making it and I can imagine being on set for a movie like Batman Forever or Batman and Robin and being like, well, there's sure a lot of money in this production. Yeah. Like, look at these sets and look at these costumes and look at this stuff. Like, I mean, I feel like we can trust.
There's incredible power in the idea of someone knows what's going on.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's amazing the stuff that happens in this world because of that idea right there. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly someone must know what's going on.
Yeah.
When in reality, there's a lot of times when people have a good idea of what they are doing. And since there's enough people who are focusing on their one thing, but there may not be that one person that knows exactly what's going on.
Yep.
And
the person who does know what's going on is insane. Like, and they are running things the way they want them mm-hmm. to run. 'Cause I think there's a thing that, like Joel Schumacher, when he made those Batman movies, he was trying to emulate the Adam West movies from the 60s.
Yep. And then contemporize it.
And he was trying to contemporize it. It is so bizarre, the clashing of like the contemporary, his weird like neon contemporary aesthetic, 90s aesthetic, mm-hmm. with that like, holy macaroni Batman. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, having like a bat bomb, what's that for? You know, like all this stuff that is very Adam West, which the Adam West 1960s Batman stuff was a spoof. It was not meant to be
taken seriously
to be a faithful adaptation of the comic book series, but it also was reflective of what comics were like at the mm-hmm. time. Schumacher's movies were not a reflection of the current Batman comics. They were they were a callback to that, but no one got it because the aesthetics didn't match. I would still love to see a modern movie that has the same costumes from the 1960s Batman, where you have like Will Ferrell and someone else.
I had this, I don't know if I told you about it.
I think we might have talked about it.
I think that the studios absolutely missed on an opportunity to have Will Ferrell and Ben Stiller as Batman and Robin.
Uh-huh.
If they would have done it 10 to 15 years ago,
yeah,
when they were both, you know, still in their early 40s, late 30s.
You could still do it with someone, and like that kid who played McLovin could be Robin. Yeah, but you have those costumes from the 60s, and you have down to the Riddler and the Penguin, and everyone looks like they look back then. And it's just another one of those movies, and you treat it just like you would if Adam West had been in the movie. And
there's totally a market for it.
I mean, and that's it's like you have to like make sure that you fully go there. It was a weird choice for Joel Schumacher to be like, we're going to wink at those movies and really kind of take their lot of cues from their dialogue, but then we're going to make it cool and edgy.
I think that's a fascinating topic of things that if you could time travel and go back and experience certain things that you loved as a child, as the age that you are now, what your experience would have been like. And I've got to imagine, I loved Batman Forever when it came out. I remember just, oh, this is my favorite Batman.
Uh-huh.
And then I've seen it as an adult and just, oh my gosh, this is close to unwatchable. This is terrible.
It's insane.
But loved it. I think I probably saw it in the theater three times, mm-hmm. you know?
That's why when people, my friend and I were talking about this the other day, because people love to shit on Zack Snyder and people talk about, I love the movie Watchmen, but there's a lot of people that are like, oh, it's one of the
Brandon.
Yeah. It's one of the worst superhero movies ever made. And I'm like, do you know how bad superhero movies are? Do you know how many bad, like, have you ever seen Green Lantern? Have you ever seen Batman and Robin? Have you ever seen, like Watchmen is not one of the worst superhero movies ever made. It's far from it. It's not even close to
top five.
In my opinion, it's one of the best superhero movies ever made. I also feel that way about Man of Steel. Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, you might be mad about the third act of Man of Steel, and you might think that it goes a little over the top.
It's a great movie, though, leading up to it.
And I still think, hey, that's what a fight between two Kryptonians would look like. Now, we can talk all day about, would Superman allow that level of destruction, or wouldn't he have taken Zod out to the desert and had it happen there? But you have to take into account, in my opinion, this is my defense of that movie, is it's his first time ever being Superman. This is his first foray out.
He's gonna screw up.
He's discovering that whole movie, who he is, and just how strong he is, and what he's capable of, and how what's the most responsible way to do this and to hone his power.
He's gonna grow from that first experience.
The whole story with him and his dad is, his dad's like, I don't want you going public yet because I don't think you're old enough or mature enough to understand the ramifications of what your kind of power could, you know, could bring to the world. And I think in that movie, you're seeing him learning actively. And you even see in the next movie that he's like, okay, I need to be more judicious about where I and how I handle these things. But also, it's like in the comics, they're constantly blowing through buildings and knocking shit over and stuff. I just think when people talk about that as one of the worst superhero movies ever and Zack Snyder sucks, it's like, have you seen Daredevil with Ben Affleck? Have you seen Elektra? They get really bad.
Clearly, no, you have not.
Yeah, they get really, really, really bad. Fantastic Four, any of them?
Just
any of them
bad.
You know?
Yeah, any of them. Jeez, there's any been of three, them. And they'll remake it again now that Disney owns Fox. They'll just reboot it.
Mm-hmm.
It probably won't be good again.
Yeah, I mean they get anyway. What a cliffhanger. Anyway, what? What was I gonna say right then? What's the rest of the conversation? Well, for that info, you're just gonna have to tune in next week, because that's it for part one. If you want the rest of this juicy conversation, you're just gonna have to come back next week, all right? I'm sorry, that's how it has to go. We talked for too long. We're very long-winded. I'm long-winded. And he's long-winded, all right? I'm probably more long-winded than he is, but he can keep pace with me. And so, you know, we went too long, and I wasn't going to cut it, because that's my big bro right there, all right? I wasn't even going to cut any of it down. He's too special, all right? So come back next week and find out what the rest of the conversation is. Not to give anything away, but it might be very similar to this week's conversation, you know? But I mean, who knows? There might be some dramatic twists and turns. Like, we might find out that one of us had a Siamese twin that was removed at birth, and he comes on the show, and suddenly it's a three brothers podcast. I don't know. You know, I'm not saying that does happen, but I'm also not saying it doesn't happen. I'm saying you have to come back next week to find out is the thing, all right? People Pleaser is written, edited, produced, and hosted by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com. You can also see more of my other projects there, or you can just look up Austin Archer on Apple Music or Spotify and see my stuff there. The show is mixed and mastered by Marmalade Music. Right now, for the next 7 days, if you go to marmalademusicslc.com telling me listen to the show, Chris over at Marmalade Music is going to mix and master your first song for free. So that's crazy. Go do that. And while you're at it, head on over to Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star rating, and write a review, and I'll read that review on the show, and I'll review you back. Okay? Let's do that. I mean, come on, isn't that fun? That's fun. So, yeah, go do that. I think that's it. I think that's all I got this week. Cool. Peace and love. Bye.
We've been hanging and banging, brother.